Thursday, the 13th of September, is World Sepsis Day, bringing awareness to a condition which causes 6 million deaths worldwide every year. Accurately quantifying the incidence and disease burden of sepsis is difficult for a number of reasons, but new research published by the MJA has investigated ways of making the all-important epidemiological data more accurate. Professor Simon Finfer, a research fellow at the George Institute for Global Health and a critical care specialist at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, is a lead author of that research, and he's here today to talk all things sepsis with me. Sepsis, why is it so difficult to accurately quantify the incidence of sepsis in Australia?
Well, it's not only in Australia, it's actually been a significant problem all around the world. Maybe I can just start with a little bit of general stuff about sepsis, if you
don't
mind.
Yes, please.
Apart from those of us who are intimately involved in treating people with sepsis and researching sepsis, it's been a bit of a Cinderella condition that is poorly understood. I mean, people will frequently say a patient is septic without really understanding what that should mean. There's no blood test to confirm sepsis. There's no histological test to confirm sepsis. There's no radiological test to confirm sepsis. So the gold standard or reference standard for the diagnosis is still a clinical one, which is the presence of organ dysfunction due to a dysregulated immunological response to infection. And obviously for disease surveillance or epidemiological research or clinical research, it's not practical to do repeated clinical diagnoses on a wide scale, document them accurately. So around the world, there have been various attempts to use administrative data sets to do that. Often ICD coding is used, but ICD coding, there are two problems there. One is that unless someone actually writes diagnosis of sepsis in the medical record, it doesn't get coded. So if someone writes query sepsis, which is a frequent occurrence, then that doesn't get counted. So there have been a number of attempts around the world to try and use these administrative data sets, and they produce quite marked variations in the estimate. It hasn't appeared in the Global Burden of Disease statistics. In the Global Burden of Disease project has considered sepsis to be what they call one of their garbage codes. So if your cause of death, even if someone writes cause of death sepsis on a death certificate, the Global Burden of Disease previously would look at what is the underlying infection and then attribute the death to the infection. For that reason, sepsis didn't appear. Now, that is changing, because through some of my other international roles, we have got a project going on at IHME, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, University of Washington, who produced the Global Burden of Disease statistics. And we've had people working there, and they've put a team on it. And so this year, for the first time, sometime later this year, we hope the Global Burden of Disease will produce their statistics on the global burden of sepsis. So that will be very helpful. What we do know, I mean, there's quite good data out of the US where half to a third of all hospital deaths are either caused or sepsis contributes to or causes those deaths. The most expensive DRG, the direct costs in the US have been estimated at $27 billion a year.
Wow.
And in the UK, which you might think is maybe a bit more of a similar healthcare system, because obviously costs in the US are very inflated.
Yeah.
They have also had an official government initiated estimate of sepsis costs there, and their estimate is £7.8 billion per year. If you correct that for current currency exchange and population size, that would equate to $6.2 billion Australian dollars for the Australian population.
Wow.
The direct cost, hospital healthcare costs of that would be around 700 million, which is a bit less than the estimate that we've produced at the George Institute of 846 million in direct hospital treatment costs per year. So this is not a trivial problem at all. And as a result, we certainly, and when I say we, I'm referring to those people who are researching sepsis. We have within hosted at the George Institute, we have the Australian Sepsis Network, which is an umbrella organisation of a broad group of people who are trying to improve sepsis care and outcomes. And in that, we produced a report last year where we estimated the cost at about $846 million, and that's the direct hospital cost. So that's probably an underestimate. The difficulty with getting really good epidemiological data, and you might say, well, why bother? I mean, but hopefully it's obvious to people that we should understand epidemiology of all the major, all healthcare conditions, ideally, but certainly a major public health problem like this, so that we can appropriately plan, you know, provisions of healthcare, et cetera. We can conduct disease surveillance. We can study the impact of new treatments or new approaches to detecting and treating sepsis. And also, these data are very important when, for instance, the MRFF or the NHMRC are considering their research priorities. If there are a major problem like this, it's been recognized more and more so, and I think the UK and the US have, and other countries, Ireland, for instance, have recognized what a major problem it is. And we can't expect that the appropriate priority will be given to research funding if we can't actually produce accurate numbers and tell those making the decisions about priorities and healthcare planning what the impact is.
So basically, the research you're publishing in the MJA sets out to see if the epidemiological methods are accurate in terms of the incidence that they're estimating for sepsis in ICUs in Australia.
Yes. Probably the most influential recent paper was the paper that analysed the ANZICS, let's say Australian New Zealand Intensive Care Society CORE, which is Centre for Outcome Research and Evaluation, data set, which is a huge data set of, you know, over a million ICU admissions, and analysed that data set using a method that was similar to what has been used with ICD coding, which is either patients were admitted to the ICU and their admission diagnosis was listed as sepsis, or their admission diagnosis was an infection. And analyzing the data that are collected for the severity of illness score, that those data were then analyzed to see if someone had an infection and they had organ dysfunction, and then that was called sepsis as well. The problem with the CORE data set, it's based on data in the first 24 hours in the ICU. It's basically a severity of illness score that's calculated based on the data generated from the first 24 hours in the ICU. So anyone who developed sepsis beyond that would not be counted.
Ah, okay.
And additionally, the numbers that they produced we considered to be an underestimate, and particularly not only undercounting the number of cases, but also underestimating death. So obviously, if you multiply an underestimated incidence by an underestimated mortality rate, you're going to compound the issue and produce a figure for the number of deaths that's a significant underestimate.
How do we fix this?
Well, what we did, and I have to recognise the extraordinary efforts of the first two authors on the paper, which was Manon Heldens and Marinella Schoot, who were two Dutch medical students who approached me at a meeting in Europe and said, we'd like to come to Australia to do our research internship. They came for 4 months, and they may have thought they were going to sit on the beach, but they didn't. They worked extraordinarily hard, and they reviewed every patient in our 60-bed ICU every day during the period that they were with us. And after, obviously, we'd done a lot of work before they got here in terms of getting the ethical approval and the protocol and approval by their own university back in the Netherlands. And they used, you know, by reviewing every patient every day, they made a clinical diagnosis of sepsis, which is the current gold or reference standard. And then at the same time, we submit data to CORE. So we collected the CORE data set and we applied the exact same methodology that was described in the 2012 paper. And we confirmed our suspicion, and obviously you always worry about bias when people have a suspicion and then say they've confirmed it, but yeah. I'm confident that these data are accurate. So we came up using the database method with a sepsis count that was two-thirds of what it should have been using the clinical diagnosis, and also a mortality rate of 17%, which was very close to the 18.4% reported from CORE. But the clinical sepsis population diagnosed as sepsis using the clinical definition had a mortality rate of 27%. That's in-hospital mortality censored at 60 days. Clearly, it's not practical to have people review every patient in ICU and the hospital, because this is just ICU-treated sepsis.
Yeah.
It's not. There's a lot of sepsis that occurs in the hospital that doesn't make it to the ICU for one reason or another. And it's impractical to do that, but we wanted to do this process to, first of all, to generate what we think are some more accurate data. And secondly, this process, I think, can be used to calibrate administrative data sets. So this has been done in the US. There was a very nice paper published in JAMA, which I was asked to write the editorial for, which I did. They did a similar exercise published in JAMA using ICD coding and then calibrating it. They used retrospective chart review, which obviously is a little less accurate than doing prospective evaluation as we did. My proposal would be that we continue to use administrative data sets for disease surveillance, which is the only practical approach, but that we periodically calibrate these data sets using clinical diagnosis. And we can do that, obviously, should be done in more than one hospital, and periodically we could then, as I say, calibrate these administrative data approaches and get accurate data. There are a lot of quality improvement programs going on around the world and in Australia, so that the Clinical Excellence Commission in New South Wales has been running the Sepsis Kills project very successfully for some years. The Clinical Excellence Division in Queensland has implemented a program for both adult and pediatric sepsis, and Safer Care Victoria is also taking a great interest in sepsis and rolling out a process that was developed in one of the cancer hospitals and rolling that out across Victoria. These quality improvement approaches have been consistently have improved outcomes for patients with sepsis. Being able to evaluate how accurately how quality improvement programs are or are not improving outcomes is very important.
I'm chatting today with Professor Simon Finfer from the George Institute of Global Health. Simon's co-authored research on sepsis in Australian ICUs is published at www.mja.com.au and, like all our research, is open access. Is there something doctors on the coalface or nurses on the coalface even who are charting these patients, is there something they could be doing better that would improve the data set?
Ultimately, I think in the ICU, everyone's pretty aware of sepsis. And as I said, the CORE data set it's an excellent data set. It's done a fantastic job over many, many years. It's been very useful for epidemiological research, but it does have some structural limitations, only collecting the first 24 hours of data. So for the false negative diagnoses of sepsis, and this is obviously in the paper, the big ones were the Apache diagnosis, which is acute physiology and chronic health evaluation. It's a severity of illness scoring system. You allocate the patient one code, their primary reason for admission to ICU, and that is off. That there, the inter-rater variability in that is quite large. So if someone comes from the ICU, from the operating theatre, having been admitted to the ICU after they've had a procedure for a bowel perforation, for example, they could be coded as post-operative abdominal surgery. Whereas if they were coded post-operative, intra-abdominal sepsis, right, then they would get counted as sepsis. There are problems with allocating the Apache coding. The other, that accounted for nearly 60% of the false negative diagnoses, the Apache coding. Another quarter, and these are the two big ones, was that the sepsis was diagnosed beyond 24 hours in the ICU. So the data only comes from the first 24 hours, so that's gonna miss a quarter. So it's hard to improve those. You can improve the Apache coding, perhaps. Outside of the ICU, the most important thing is that people actually start to accurately and appropriately use the term sepsis and document it in the medical record. And even more than that is the fact that there's very low awareness of sepsis in the general population. We've surveyed that, and only 40% of Australians have heard of sepsis, and only 17% thought that were able to say that fever, shivering, and shaking could be a sign of sepsis. The other signs of sepsis that we would like the general population to be aware of, like rapid heart rate, rapid respiratory rate, low urine output, mental confusion, skin rashes, etc., were only 1-2% of the people we surveyed thought that those things might be indicative of sepsis in the context of an infection. So we have a major awareness problem, and that does extend, as I said, the term sepsis or septic is used very loosely. Often when people call me and say, this person's got is septic, what they mean is they've got a temperature, and it's not the same thing, obviously. So we can improve, if we improve awareness within those, at the coalface, what actually sepsis is, the terminology, please write it, actually document it when it exists, then it'll get coded, because ultimately we will use ICD-9 coding, and the Global Burden of Disease will publish the methodology that we've been working on. That will be published sometime later this year, and I expect that methodology to be picked up in individual countries around the world. The WHO passed a resolution on sepsis in 2017, and one of the things that they called for was improved epidemiological data, and specifically improving the use of the ICD system to accurately account for sepsis. There's one other thing I'd like to mention, which I think is very valuable and not, it's a bit tangential. The other thing about which there is extremely limited understanding, both in the medical, particularly in the medical community, actually, are the long-term sequelae of sepsis. When I started doing intensive care, which was 30 years ago, the mortality rate for septic shock was about 60-70%. And we quite reasonably spent our time researching how do we reduce mortality, and we counted the number of dead people, and the number of dead people went down, and we thought we were doing very well. We now have a mortality rate, sepsis of 27% and septic shock of 37%, which sounds very high, but it does mean that 70-odd% of people who have sepsis are surviving. And until very recently, we really didn't pay those people much attention. And what has become clear through research over the last 5 years or so, is that people who have sepsis have significant long-term health problems, physical, cognitive, and psychological problems, very high incidence of PTSD, cognitive impairment, that in people who had no detected or diagnosed cognitive problems prior to having sepsis, a significant proportion will have cognitive impairment that equates to moderate or severe dementia afterwards. And also, sometimes the physical effects are obvious because we have a group of sepsis survivors who are helping us with this work who a large number of those are quadruple amputees. That's very obvious. Everyone can see they have a bad effect, but also there are a lot of other physical impairments. And at the Australian Sepsis Network, we have a website with Contact Us. And the commonest contact that we get is from people who've had sepsis who contact us and say, there's something wrong with me. I can't think straight. I can't sleep. I can't go back to work. I can't do my job properly. I'm worried about losing my job. Yep. And the financial stress, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been to several doctors, and they all tell me that there's nothing wrong with me. that I've recovered. And so I think it again, whilst we're looking here at base epidemiology of sepsis, we also need to not just count the number of people who've died. We need to pay a great deal more attention. And that's one of our goals, is to develop, improve awareness and develop coordinated care for the survivors. Because the burden, as I said, in the US, the UK estimate of £7.8 billion per year for sepsis, about 80% of that cost is the indirect costs beyond hospital discharge of, obviously there's the returning to hospital costs, but the costs in terms of people losing jobs and becoming, you know, dependent on, yeah, on welfare, and the economic cost to the community of that, which is substantial. Direct healthcare costs are enormous, but the indirect costs afterwards are also, you know, are several magnitudes higher. It is a big problem, and we're slowly but surely getting a bit more attention to the magnitude of the problem, and the accurate epidemiological data is critical to that if we're going to get government engagement and we're going to get it pushed up the research priorities from where it currently is.
It sort of seems to be something that you have to wait for external signs before you can do anything about. Does that make sense?
The reason we want to improve community awareness,
yeah,
and this is which is very critical, is because 80% of sepsis arises in the community. It actually presents to the emergency department. Quality improvement programs around the world and in Queensland and Victoria, mm-hmm, are very reasonably focusing on the emergency department, because that's the first place to try and improve awareness and recognition. Because when people have developed, and I think GPs have an extraordinarily difficult job. People, you know, 99.9% of the people who present to the GP who appear to have a cold or the flu will have a cold or the flu. And then there's the odd person who is going to develop sepsis. And the only effective treatment is early appropriate antibiotics. And so improving awareness, obviously if you come to hospital with you've had a head injury, some sort of traumatic injury, and the emergency department decide to send you home, they generally send you home with a list of instructions: come back if these things happen.
Yeah.
And we need the same for sepsis.
Yes.
So that when people, if they present to their GP and they look okay, that they can say, okay, you've got the flu and, you know, you need symptomatic treatment, but if these things happen, please present yourself either back here or to a hospital, because the early administration of appropriate antibiotics is the only thing that has consistently been shown to reduce mortality. And there's concerns about that because people, we're obviously all concerned about antimicrobial resistance. And so there's been concern that if we say, okay, you've got to give antibiotics once you have these signs, and you've got to give them within an hour,
yeah,
because every hour you delay increases the risk of death by 4 to 8%. First, people's reaction has largely been, oh, goodness, if we're going to give antibiotics to everyone and they're all going, you know, we're going to have a huge resistance problem. But there's very good data from a number of countries around the world, actually some very, very good data from Ireland, that shows that adopting a awareness and rapid diagnosis and treatment protocol, as they have done nationally in Ireland, reduces the total amount of antibiotic used and reduces resistance. Because the people who really get huge, you know, doses of antibiotics are the people who don't get treated early, and then they remain on antibiotics for a long time. Whereas if we treat people early, we end up giving less total antibiotics. Kind of win-win. Obviously, we understand people's concerns about antimicrobial resistance. Working in an ICU, I'm very well aware of them. But an approach to sepsis, which is, if you fit these criteria, rapid, you know, take cultures, give antibiotics, the most important thing. That approach does not increase the total amount of antibiotic used. It actually reduces it. It doesn't increase resistance.
Thanks, Simon.
All right, pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.